Wednesday, November 27th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. One phrase that is not often recognized as an oxymoron, but plausibly could be, is bit much. He's a bit much. You know, Rudy Giuliani, that guy's a bit much. But I do have a secret opinion about what Rudy's going through. I dare not share it out loud. I really shouldn't. Like I said, it's dangerous. So Rudy was in court yesterday, then outside of court, complaining about the ruling that he has to pay $148 million to Georgia election workers he lied about and defamed. Rudy's not happy. He says he's tapped out in every resource but ire.
Did I have a fair trial? I didn't have a trial. Half the time she was threatening to throw me in jail, like he is vaguely doing. Meanwhile, he said something that's totally untrue. I'm not worried about Mr. Giuliani having... The reality is, I have no cash. It's all tied up. So right now, if I wanted to call a taxi cab, I can't do it. I don't have a credit card. I don't have a checking account.
Yeah, don't feel bad for Rudy. That guy is a bit much. And he should pay. He ruined those women's lives. But here's my crazy secret, and it relates to bit much. I think $148 million is a bit much. I'm just saying, it's just a little bit too much. Oh, they had a horrible time, but did they have a $148 million horrible time? How do you even get to $148 million? I know, there's a calculation and loss of wages and suffering and punitive and all that, but what I'm saying is a bit much. I don't want Rudy Giuliani to get to keep his watches or all his houses or to keep his dignity. Sorry, someone beat me to that. That'd be Rudy Giuliani. But $148 million? Bit much. Here's a rule of thumb. If I told you, you would have to go through what Ruby Freeman and Wondrea Moss went through, and all you'd have to show for it after 3 years of harassing phone calls and stares in the market and lost sleep and smears online, and all you'd have to show for it was... $148 million? You'd take it. Everyone worth less than $5 or $10 million would take it. They'd be silly not to. A punishment for an offense that 99% of the people would say, okay, you can punish me with that. Well, that is not what I would call proportional. Oh, I know all the caveats. He doesn't really have that much money. They're not going to get all that money. They should get a lot of money. He should be forced to give it all away, maybe almost all away. Yeah, I get all that. He should pay a high price. I'm just saying, I think you know what I'm saying, that $148, doesn't it seem a bit much? Plus, other people are suing Rudy, like the assistant he forced to perform her job in her underwear. I don't think there'll be anything left for her. And this, ladies and gentlemen, has been my ongoing segment of the least sympathetic victims in the world. Rudy Giuliani. Up next, Gaddafi. Seems like a guy you can make a deal with on the show today. But wait, maybe you're saying, Mike, I want more of these insights. For instance, today we have a bonus interview for subscribers. Quite likely you're saying, I want less show in general. Well, we can take out the commercials. Subscribe to The Gist ad-free or The Gist Pesca Plus, which is also ad-free, at subscribe.mikepesca.com. And you get a better, different, and meatier or less time-consuming show, depending on how you look at it. And let me tell you this. For a limited time only, we are having a sale. Buy a present for a friend. 20% off. It will be a Black Friday sale if you choose to do it on Friday. Today, it's an Off-White Wednesday sale. Tomorrow, sort of a Gray Thursday sale. But it will culminate in a Black Friday sale. To get 20% off, go to subscribe.mikepesca.com and use the promo code HufflepuffSnuffleupagus. This is my idea for a generous offer that no one is actually able to cash in on because it's impossible to spell. That is HufflepuffSnuffleupagus. The traditional Welsh spelling of Snuffleupagus, of course. All right, I'm just kidding. I'm not kidding. You can try to use that code. But the promo code is cheese. Use cheese at subscribe.mikepesca.com for 20% off. Or Hufflesnuffleuffle. On the show today, Elizabeth Warren should play nice with the incoming administration. But first, I'm joined once again by Sean Peterson and Tom Balcerski, who collaborated on a new documentary, Lover of Men, The Untold History of Abraham Lincoln. Sean, Tom, and Abe, up next. Yesterday on the show, we talked with historian Thomas Balcerski and filmmaker Sean Peterson on their new movie, Lover of Men, The Untold History of Abraham Lincoln. In this part of the interview, we were going to get into why it's so important, very important, to try to show that Abraham Lincoln was, in fact, a lover of men and vice versa. Not just humanity, but specific men. Specific, sweaty, bed-sharing fellows. And the last thing that was discussed in part one of the interview yesterday was the idea of fluidity and how back in Lincoln time, there was no binary. So I wanted to get into that a little bit. Tell me about the fluidity, because I think a common understanding is to fixate our minds somewhere in the recent past and maybe forget, wait, was Lincoln around at the same time as Oscar Wilde, who was jailed for sodomy? And then you think about the Victorian era, which Queen Victoria, I think, you know, this is about 1900, but of course she was born many decades earlier. So what was the state of play for our definition of concepts like fluidity and just the what society deemed to be the impermissibility of any gay acts?
Well, that's a good question. Tom, I'm sure has something to say there, but it's interesting you brought up Oscar Wilde, because you think about Oscar Wilde or Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, or Ralph Waldo Emerson or Lord Byron, all men that historians have said, oh yeah, those guys definitely had sex with other men. But every one of those names were all married to women and all had children with women. Oscar Wilde was married to a woman and had a child. So it was very common, again, in that time, Lincoln was a man of his time, to have been with women, but also to have been with men. And it was through, and the problem with Lincoln is, and the reason historians, and John Stoffer from Harvard goes into this quite extensively when he talks about the film and talks about the time, all these other men, Byron, Wilde, Melville, were all artists. And it's okay, you know, Walt Whitman, certainly, artists were okay to be gay. But when you take the grandfather of the grand old party, of the Republicans, that is a sacred figure to the right, and they are not going to let him go there, you know? So that's the gatekeeping that's happening, is protecting his manliness. And this absurd notion that, yeah, he split rails by force, basically, by his father, but he did not like to do labor. These paintings of him with the axe and the big muscles, and yes, he wrestled like a lot of guys did, but not to the extent that he was this manly man that myth has made him.
Right, but all those other artists, I take your point, there is much more explicit, and I'm not using that word as to have innuendo or two or three meanings. They explicitly, you could trace their writings to them talking quite explicitly about homosexual
activity. None of their writing is explicit. None of them. Even Whitman, who wrote multiple versions of Leaves of Grass, he never stopped writing that book, and he never got more explicit. It was all metaphor. Everything was metaphor. Even his private letters never talked explicitly about sex acts. Because again, in the Victorian era, that was improper. So whenever anyone's like, well, where's the smoking gun that Lincoln had sex, and where's the exact writing that he, like, I held speed in my arms? It doesn't exist, but it doesn't exist him talking about sex acts with Mary Todd either. In fact, heterosexuals at the time did not, or people that had heterosexual sex primarily, didn't have explicit letters. No one really wrote like that in the Victorian period. So to find evidence one way or the other, Hugh Ryan, who's a historian that's in our film, he talks a lot about that.
Sean, you're just wrong about Walt Whitman. I mean, in Calmus, he writes about, or if you will be thrusting me beneath your clothing where I feel the throbs of your heart, for thus merely touching you is enough at best, and thus touching you will I silently hope and be carried eternally. I mean, he's being explicit.
Right. But it's an androgynous person he's addressing.
He doesn't talk about whether that's a male or a woman. Yeah, and yeah. He also had lots of flirtatious moments with women throughout his life too, Whitman did. You know, he was a total flirt. So that, again, that you can interpret whether that what gender those people were in that writing there. Yep. I mean, he certainly talked about what are the cattails? What are those that grew along the banks of Brooklyn?
Yeah,
the cattails. They're very phallus. weed that would grow along the kind of the banks of Brooklyn. And he would write about those. But again, it's a metaphor, right? It was a phallus metaphor.
Right. Yeah, that's so true. And without making a claim to be a literary scholar, that's actually where Dr. John Stauffer would be really helpful in this conversation. We also have another scholar in the film, Dr. Lisa Diamond, who speaks to this idea of sexual fluidity and to the question that Mike raised earlier. It feels like this is a good time to say that when we get to the Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman at the end of his life, that is actually the beginning of a moment of repression of sexual and social scientific definitioning of heterosexuality, which comes as a kind of response to homosexuality. But in Lincoln's day, two generations earlier, early Victorian, if you will, because Victoria lives a long life, that's where we see, by contrast, a much more open attitude towards sexuality. And particularly, we see homosocial environments, i.e. men with other men, women with other women, being prioritized, valued, and celebrated. And Lincoln is born right at this time, right? Really, it's one of these last moments to be born in America in the 19th century, where this was still the reigning kind of view of sexuality of the day. And without these categories, without these repressions, without these closeting forces, these kinds of physical connections between men and between women were much more common. And I say that with knowing that the evidence is difficult to be definitive and to prove in the way we would want. Sean's right. We don't get that as explicit language in letters. So you have to read with the evidence you do have and the situations you do have creatively to try to understand and make the possibilities for these actions.
I mean, one of the scholars in our film, Jonathan Ned Katz, who's considered kind of the godfather of queer studies, is so annoyed with this idea that, oh, men shared beds and that there's no sex happening. But his extensive research and his extensive collection of letters show otherwise. I mean, that's kind of his expertise, is the sex that was happening in these time frames. And Lisa Diamond, who's a scientist, who's a social scientist who studies fluidity, really talks about how this time, like when you go back to the Greeks and the Romans, the Egyptians, everyone's like, oh, sure, the Greeks and the Romans, we know about their fluidity. But that did not really change until around 1870, when people invented these words, homosexual and heterosexual. That's when those words were made up. Sexuality was made up in 1870. It didn't really become popular until the early 20th century. And it wasn't really until after the Roaring Twenties that it even existed in the popular culture. So those concepts are completely invented very recently.
Well, it could have very well been. And if we were somehow to know the truth and I had to put money on it, I think your film has convinced me that you'd have to give me pretty good odds to say he's never had any sort of act of sex with a man. Okay. But there is the standards of proof. And Tom, you talk about this, that objectivity in this era, if you were to go by the dominant modes of how we prove anything in history, what you will wind up with is a situation was, oh, I guess there was no homosexuality in the 19th century. So that's quite ridiculous. But the question is, in lowering the standards of proof, how do you make sure you don't just allow to slip in any narrative that people in the current day would like to ascribe to our founding fathers? So here's my concern. If we call a thing a fact that's not a fact, or if we call a thing provable that's not provable, and if we don't have any real standards for this, or if we're not scrupulous about saying, as best we could tell, here's where the evidence adds up, then you get situations like you have all these scholars, quote unquote scholars, calling the founding fathers explicitly Christian, saying they meant to start America as a Christian nation, read between the lines, look at things through a Christian lens rather than an agnostic or atheistic lens, and our founding fathers just become fodder for any story we want to tell.
Facts are stubborn things, mm-hmm. John Adams once said. Yeah, if you want to be stubborn, you can go with facts the rest of your life. This is an interpretation.
You like going with facts.
As a historian, I like to inquire and tell stories. I mean, I use facts and evidence, but that's not all I do. I'm not an encyclopedia writer. I interpret this stuff. And so, right, like originalism, bad. I agree. This is what you're getting at. Like, okay, we can invent a jurisprudence philosophy that comes from a series of readings of facts. I'll take those same facts and, from what I hear, go with you and be like, the founding fathers would be horrified by the legal philosophy that's emerged in the Supreme Court today. Counterpoint, right? So, like, when it comes to sexuality, there are very few facts in the way we want them to be. There are very few, you know, use that metaphor, the smoking gun. We don't get a lot of things that prove it definitively beyond the shadow of the doubt. But why are we trying to prove sexuality? Like, in what world is this like a court trial that if someone is, you know, having this besmirched on them, it's somehow a problem for society? That's the problem. And that's homophobia, right? That's like fearing this idea about sexuality being something other than straight or the other. And I don't want to be the other. I want to be the straight, right? That's what the majority would in this like scenario would have us believe. That's the beauty of this film. We don't think the majority wants it anymore. Or at least we don't think this next generation and emerging generations would want this for their future or for their past.
And I think just as an extension to what Tom was saying, this idea that you have to prove Lincoln is gay, as if that is a crime, a terrible charge, is a homophobic premise. This idea that the baseline throughout history was heterosexuality, it wasn't. That is not the norm through most of human history. Fluidity was. So we're really applying a 2024 idea, prove he was gay because this is a bad thing and you must prove the opposite. Well, prove that he was heterosexual, that he had four kids. Do we know any other gay men that were married and had kids and then married a man afterwards? Are there not millions of examples of that? The only proof that he was heterosexual was that he did marry a woman and had some children. But that's not proof.
Well, proof and facts and truth are the realm of the historian. I understand that interpretation and stories are also important, but they have to have a ballast of the things that happened or didn't. I would say that there is some proof that, I don't know if he was straight or gay, he certainly had sex with women and seemed to have romantic attachments to women, not just Mary Todd Lincoln, who he battled with. There were prior lovers or people that he was in love with, seemingly romantic love. I don't know if your documentary gets into any of them. Does it, by the way, of say, what was her name?
The supposed Matilda Edwards that
Anne
he kind of had a crush on.
Anne Rutledge was the one, even her grave marker to this day says something like Lincoln's first sweetheart. He seemed to have been so upset by her. He seemed to be almost suicidal by her passing. I mean, this could be just a friend that he was suicidal about, but the same expression of anguish that he showed for Elmer Ellsworth, which is taken in your movie to be an example of perhaps a romantic love, the historical record shows that he felt that with Anne Rutledge.
I would say there's a way to read Anne Rutledge differently. The film doesn't, because that would divert us for another hour. In fact, one of the first sort of entries that C.A. Tripp and his editor, Louis Gannett, who also wrote and as a scholar, did in this world was to try to like test the assumptions of the Anne Rutledge theory. And there's a fantastic article Louis published, which actually informed Tripp's work, which informs my work, which informs his film's work, to say that like, it doesn't have a leg to stand on. So I would, you know, could battle that one. Matilda Edwards is another person who, again, like someone like Professor Burlingame points to as Lincoln being deeply impassioned for. And in fact, he would say that there was almost a competition between Lincoln and Joshua Speed in Springfield for Matilda Edwards. These are all sort of secondary readings that emerge later, though. They're not sort of foundational texts, because William Herndon, who is the foundational text, provides the evidence the other way. And when Herndon is copying down faithfully what people have said about Lincoln or what Lincoln did, it's good. It's as good as any historian would do at the time. He is using the coin of the realm, facts and evidence. When Herndon speculates, as he does with Anne Rutledge, as he does with other of Lincoln's supposed loves, he does go on to shakier ground. So there's even interpretive challenges with using Herndon for these particular kinds of relationships. He also hated Mary Todd Lincoln. And so the fact that we are not trying to say that ourselves, we're not wading into that debate. That is another debate. Lincoln's, the happiness or unhappiness of Lincoln's marriage is not really a part of the film. And I don't think it necessarily is required to make the story and to make the argument that the film is making.
But is Anne Rutledge in the film? Is she mentioned in the film, Sean?
No, I didn't go to Anne Rutledge because I'm not trying to say he was exclusively heterosexual. Anne Rutledge is a whole debate, right? Because there are two sides. Like, he was sad that she died. Well, he was sad that she died, even though, and Louis Gannett does a great job, you should look up his article on this, all of her family members who she was living with do not even recall Lincoln coming around to visit. It's there's this whole debate.
It was
debate.
Very sad, right? He was suicidal. They took away his
leaders. I mean, nobody in her family described him that way. Okay. You know, like, so he was sad, but it was one of the, and you could argue that a few years before that, his sister had just died. And then his mother died when he was young. So this onslaught of death where he becomes friends with this Anne Rutledge, you know, minor friends, a lot of people would argue, this death upon death upon death really could just be this outpouring of a man who is classically a depressive.
Yes.
His sister had just died. And then this young woman, who he probably reminded him of his sister, died in his village.
Absolutely. It's absolutely true. But my only point here is that the exact same reaction to Elmer Ellsworth is taken as proof of your theory when it is ignored when it's with Anne Rutledge.
Well, but here's the thing that I think
also says he was only deeply, he was deeply uncomfortable with women, which seems to be true. He didn't have romantic attachments to women, your film posits. And to me, it's like, what is the dependent and independent variable here? Same set of circumstances, same set of crying. Maybe it means he had romantic bisexualism or something like that. But there was more of an attachment to women in, if we are to look at the Ellsworth anguish, in the exact same way as with a man as with a woman.
I don't think these are the same circumstances, because the truth is, like, there's not very little evidence of the time he spent with Anne Rutledge. We know that he cried that she died. That's what we know. We don't see a lot of evidence of them hanging out all the time. What we do know about Elmer Ellsworth is that when Elmer Ellsworth, and he saw him for the first time marching with his Zouaves and became captivated by this young man, the film can only be so long, but if you look into the study of Elmer Ellsworth, he became so captivated with this kid that he insisted that he be hired as a law clerk. And then Elmer Ellsworth was like, well, I'm not really a lawyer. He's like, well, I got to do anything to keep this kid around. He goes, okay, how about if he works for the campaign? He'll just do this marching and vote for Lincoln. And then the second he wins the election, he brings him to Washington, D.C., gives him an elevated rank, and then he lives in the White House. And then he's sent off and killed. So we have a body of evidence of how Lincoln is doing anything he can to keep this person in his presence, and then dies and cries. With Anne Rutledge, she dies, he cries. That's all we know. So these circumstances, if you watch the film, we're not just saying he slept with this guy for 4 years, end of story. We add the letters. We add what other people talk about them. We add Speed himself saying no two men were ever more intimate. You start adding things and adding things and adding things, and that's where you come up with the theory. We're not trying to queer every president that ever lived. I would never make a movie that George Washington was queer. I'm only going to make the movie where there's a lot of evidence, you know?
So there is evidence. I understand what evidence is. Evidence isn't proof, but evidence is, if you add it all up, different.
And yes, that was the Pesca classic fade out. We mentioned there's more of this interview, and indeed there is. If you want to listen to 8 more minutes, in fact, become a Pesca Plus member at subscribe.mikepesca.com. And for 20% off, use the promo code CHEESE or Hufflepuff Snuffleupagus.
And now the spiel. I read a headline over in Politico. This is the new progressive strategy for warring with Trump. Even Senator Elizabeth Warren is finding common ground with Trump. Donald Trump? Apparently so. Progressive Democrats wrestling with how to navigate a second Trump presidency are settling on a new approach. Take his populist working class proposals at his word, or at least pretend to. They go on to talk about Senator Warren. Even Senator Elizabeth Warren, DMAS, the resistance icon, who popularized the motto, "Nevertheless, she persisted," while skewering a Trump cabinet pick in 2017, is finding common cause with the president-elect.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Yes, of course. Nevertheless, she persisted. Cabinet pick. Began jogging my memory. Which cabinet pick was it that she was persisting about? And then I remembered. It was Jeff Sessions. Jeff Beauregard Sessions. Persistence did not pay off in terms of denying him the nomination. All 52 Republicans plus Joe Manchin voted to confirm him. 27 voted no. One voted present. Who was that? Jeff Sessions. And it didn't pay off in terms of constraining him while in office. He's very passionate about immigration and worked hard with Stephen Miller to pass several, well, eventually pass several immigration crackdowns. But then Sessions got fired by Trump for not being helpful enough and getting in the way of the Mueller investigation. And we got Bill Barr, and Bill Barr was confirmed by a greater margin above Warren's persisting, nevertheless persisting objection. And then Mueller went away, and Barr wound up being critical of Trump's desire to use the military on the streets of America and election chicanery. So what really did Warren's persistence get her? It got her a slogan, a T-shirt, that reference in Wikipedia, popularity with her constituents, I guess some standing within the caucus. You know, I think when you are a bonafide firebrand, they make a T-shirt about the things you say. And when you're a wannabe firebrand, they make a T-shirt about the things said about you. Maybe I'm wrong. T-shirts are pretty cheap these days. And That Little Girl Was Me plus Nasty Women, they were both T-shirts. One was said about her. In both cases, those T-shirts about supposed badasses were women who lost the presidential election. So it's good, I suppose, that Elizabeth Warren is learning a bit from her past and transcending her moments of iconography that did not in any meaningful way work out particularly well for her. That said, Politico has this quote from an anonymous legislative aide to a progressive member of Congress. Liberal Democrats will continue to oppose most of what Trump does, quote, tooth and nail. However, the person said, quote, "For the few policy proposals that we think will help the working class, capping credit card interest rates being one of them, we'll say put up or shut up. Because if he doesn't, it's a great win for the people of the country. Because if he does, it's a great win for millions of people across this country. And if he doesn't, it exposes him as the fraud he is." You know, Trump could read Politico, right? He doesn't read it, but someone can read it who quotes it to him. And there you are, calling him a fraud. The whole thing of, or at least pretending you agree with him, depends on you not calling him a fraud before the negotiations begin. I mean, right? We know what the new strategy is, right, guys? We are not going to oppose the parts of his agenda that we actually like. And then some political reporter comes up, offers you anonymity, and blam, the guy's scum! Sure, yeah. Not going to disagree, but he's vain scum. He's susceptible for flattery. All you have to do is express optimism at all those wonderful proposals he put forward and not say, and when I say he, I mean the known fraud, put up or shut up. That is not how pretending to be nice works, guys. You had a decent new playbook, but it requires you not to say the things you always say, even if you think them. That's the important part. You can't say them even if it's so true and you want to say them. The new strategy promised to be something other than automatic opposition, but nevertheless, they persisted. And that's it for today's show that just was produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Wara, producer. Joel Patterson, senior producer. Leo Baum is our intern. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Umperu Jeeperu Dupru, and thank you for listening.